welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is Lincoln's Negro Policy, Part 2. However much this sectional division over emancipation and colonization of the slaves may have been ignored by the historian, it was not ignored in its day, for the rejection of the Ohio Plan led to the rise of the Garrisonian abolitionists. William Lord Garrison was a supporter of the American Colonization Society. In Congress, the slave power had held that constitutional limitations rendered the federal government incapable of effecting Negro repatriation. It had, however, given evidence of a sympathy with the idea. The result of the Ohio proposals revealed the slave states in a true light as supporters of slavery and as opponents of Negro repatriation on any large scale, for not only had they denied federal ability to aid the cause, they had refused states' cooperation which would affect the same purpose. Garrison turned upon the Colonization Society and characterized it as being merely an instrument of the slave power for removing troublesome free Negroes from the presence of the slaves, with the intention of perfecting the subjection of the hapless Africans who were not free. The general plan of the society was to colonize those who were free and those who should be made free. The latter provision drew forth the frenzied ire of the slave power. It accused the society of being an instrument of the Garrisonian abolitionists. The sustained attacks upon the colonization movement by Garrison and the slave power would have obliterated it had it not been supported by men of great eminence, for Garrison and the slave power had the ears of the nation. Reputedly, they were arch enemies, but in reality they had much in common. Both opposed colonization of the Negro. Both sought to destroy the Union. Garrison, at least in theory, advocated amalgamation of the races. The slave power opposed amalgamation as a theory, but some of the slave owners seem to have practiced it. Garrison and the slave power limited the activities of the Colonization Society, but they could not destroy the society. Some 12,000 emigrants were established in Liberia. The Civil War merely suspended its operations. Important movements to Liberia continued after the Civil War. It was the Reconstruction era which devitalized the society as an agency for Negro repatriation. In 1870, although emigrants were sent to Liberia, we find agents of the society reporting to the parent organization that Reconstruction politicians were everywhere among the Negroes, urging them to abandon the idea of a Negro nation and prepare instead to take over the land of their late masters. The American Colonization Society has maintained its charter and has a complement of officials. When it relinquished control of Liberia to the American Negroes and their children residing there, the society retained substantial portions of that country for settlement by future emigrants from the United States. It is this land, thus held in trust for emigrants from the United States, which is referred to in the 1936 Virginia Memorial to Congress spoken about earlier. In 1834, when Garrison and the slave power were well underway in their attack upon those who sought to colonize the Negro, there was born near Abbeville, South Carolina, a Negro boy, Henry McNeil Turner, who was destined to be the outstanding advocate of Negro repatriation when the Negro had been made a citizen and suffrage could not be denied because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Turner, like Cuff, was freeborn. It is a significant fact that the eminent Negro leaders who encouraged the race to achieve race progress through race nationality, as other races had done, were men who had never been slaves. In most of the slave states, it was unlawful to teach a Negro to read or to write. This law could not be completely enforced, for many Negro youths of marked intelligence who were liked by white people were taught to read and write. Young Turner did menial service for certain white lawyers and was not only taught to read and write, but taught a fair amount of history and arithmetic. And in Baltimore, he studied grammar, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. Turner entered the ministry, and after some years became a bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, an all-Negro organization. In Washington, he attracted the attention of President Lincoln, who appointed him army chaplain for the first colored troops used in the Union Army. When the war was over, he was sent with the Reconstruction forces into Georgia, but resigned his commission in order to build up his church. He continued in politics. He was a delegate to the Georgia Constitutional Convention in 1867 and was a member of the state legislature for Bibb County. In 1869, he was appointed postmaster of Macon through the influence of Senator Charles Sumner, but relinquished the position in deference to opposition of white people to the appointment. In the church, he was made manager of its book concern, became bishop of Georgia, and for 12 years, he was chancellor of the Negro School, which is now Morris Brown University in Atlanta. During his official visits to Africa, he introduced Methodism there and became a staunch advocate of Negro repatriation. Bishop Turner is described as being very tall, with a powerful frame and massive head. Like Paul Cuff, he had a commanding personality. When we consider the personality and the achievements of these two eminent Negroes, we are aware that they were not ordinary individuals, but capable men who boldly proposed that the Negro in America cut loose from his moorings and voyage to a land and a government of his own. Bishop Turner knew that the race problem was more than a problem of slavery, and that it would continue as long as white women bred white children and Negro women bred Negro children. He held that the Negro would more likely obtain 409 acres of land and a hippopotamus in Africa than obtain the promised 40 acres of land and a mule in America. When told that the Negro, if he remained here, could profit by the achievements of the whites and there was no need for racial and national independence, he held that freedom for racial initiative was a prerequisite for racial progress, and that in this respect the Negro would be better off in hell than in the United States. Cuff had not witnessed organized opposition to Negro repatriation. The lifespan of Turner, however, covered the development of organized opposition. Daniel Webster proclaimed in the Senate that he would be disposed to favor the appropriation of almost any sum of money for Negro repatriation if a Southern senator would bring forth a measure to effect it. But the slave power was adamant. Turner also witnessed the complete reversal of the splendid Northern position held for half a century. The slave power held the Negro for his labor. The Garrisonians had long promised the Negroes a vote to the politicians who could free them and confer suffrage upon them. Turner saw the complete triumph of the Garrisonians, but an incomplete triumph for the Negro, for in his opinion, for when he had become an old man, he wrote to W.P. Pickett, who was preparing a publication, The Negro Problem, Abraham Lincoln's Solution, the following letter, January 1, 1907. I pray God that you will continue in the great work in which you are engaged and move this country to help the Negro to emigrate to the land of his ancestors. I know all about Africa. I have been from one end of it to the other. I have visited that continent as often as I have fingers upon my hand, and it is one of the richest continents under heaven in natural resources. This country is not compared to it, and millions of colored people in this country want to go. But to pay our way to New York, then to Liverpool, and then to Africa, is too much for the little wages the white people pay to our workers. Give us a line of steamers from Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, Pensacola, Florida, or New Orleans, Louisiana, and let us pay as much as the million or more white immigrants pay coming from Liverpool, London, and Hamburg to this country, and the Negro will leave by thousands and by tens of thousands, yes, by millions. Let us return to the colonizationists' struggle with the slave power and with Garrison. The closing phase of the struggle was marked by the rise of the greatest of the colonizationists, Abraham Lincoln to the exalted position of President of the United States. For many years, Garrison's Liberator had carried "No Union with Slave Owners" as a motto on its front page. Garrison had oft-times declared that nothing could bend his will, but under the leveled gaze of Lincoln's Garrison recoiled, and future issues of the Liberator were singularly free from proposals to destroy the Union. The other advocate of disunion was not easily suppressed. The President believed that the forces which had proclaimed a dissolution of the Union had been rallied by and were rallying around the slave power. The slave power sought to destroy the Union. It was a fitting thing, then, that the Union should destroy the slave power. The Emancipation Proclamation states that the effort to colonize persons of African descent, with their consent, would be continued. It will be found that the executive efforts which were to be continued had been directed towards obtaining land upon which Negro emigrants might settle, devising plans for compensated emancipation of the slaves, obtaining an appropriation from Congress with which to begin colonization, and an official request to Congress for a constitutional amendment to sustain a colonization program. When the President considered voluntary emancipation of the slaves, he at the same time proposed their colonization. When he proposed compensated emancipation of the slaves, he proposed their colonization. When he proclaimed their forceful emancipation, he promised their colonization. And in keeping with the promise, he submitted certain definite colonization plans to Congress. Wherever there is found a proposal for the solving of the slavery phase of the race problem, there will he find a supplementary proposal for the solution of the problem in its entirety. The executive efforts with regards to Negro colonization were not measures for the preservation of the Union. Emancipation was a war measure, but colonization was to be a post-war measure, by its nature contingent upon maintenance of the Union. Racial separation is a concept which extends beyond politics and into the realm of race. The President had not suddenly jumped to conclusions with regards to racial separation. In the years of his public life, which were the background of his executive decisions, there is found a clear view of his philosophy of the race problem. A race problem produced by contact of races was a problem that could not be solved except through the separation of the races or by their blood amalgamation. Racial separation is not a necessity. It is a possible choice between the alternatives, and its execution would be a Herculean task. No capable mind would propose such a task without having considered the issues involved in holding the races together. For many years, separation had been Mr. Lincoln's choice between the alternatives. The slave power had stood between the nation and the choice of separation. The Emancipation Proclamation was an instrument designed to destroy the slave power, and was a fit instrument to bring forwards the concept of racial separation, although its attainment would be a post-war program. The racial philosophy of Abraham Lincoln differs little, if any, from that of Thomas Jefferson. Each weighed the alternatives, and each chose separation. They considered the issues involved in holding the races together. Mr. Jefferson said, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these two people are to be free. Nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government." He declared that he wished for the Negroes the full liberties of men, but in a country of their own and in a climate congenial to them. Shortly before his election to the presidency, Mr. Lincoln went into more detail in this respect. In a Douglas-Lincoln debate, Senator Douglas had said, "For one, I am opposed to Negro citizenship in any and every form. I believe this government was made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever." To these sentiments, Mr. Lincoln replied, "I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favour of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, that I am not, nor ever have been, in favour of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. Thus, we see the background of the mental processes which led the President to include a plan of Negro colonization in the Emancipation Proclamation. The views of the President, however, and the similar positions held by Mr. Jefferson and by Mr. Douglas on this matter, were not views peculiar to these men, but were similar to those held by other eminent statesmen from the foundation of the Republic until the triumph of the Garrisonian abolitionists. Had any of the previous presidents had the power and the will to free the slaves, it is improbable that the concept of racial separation would have been omitted from the document ordaining freedom. The ideal of emancipation and colonization may be said to have been a national ideal, not opposed save by the limited number who owned slaves and by a lesser number, probably, who had continued in support of Garrison. There could be no better preface for President Lincoln's executive acts than his precise statement in a debate with Senator Douglas. Such separation, if effected at all, must be effected by colonization, and no political party as such is now doing anything directly for colonization. Party operations at present only favour or retard colonization incidentally. What colonization most needs is a hearty will. Let us be brought to believe that it is morally right, and at the same time favourable to, or at least not against, our interests, to transfer the African to his native clime, and we shall find a way to do it, however great the task may be. It was in this speech that Mr. Lincoln declared that separation of the races was the only perfect way to prevent amalgamation of the races, thus placing opponents of separation in the position of not desiring a perfect way to prevent amalgamation. Compelled to use military forces to maintain the Union, the general government was soon in possession of Negroes liberated from persons in arms against the Union. President Lincoln acted in keeping with his race ideals and with his conception that Negro repatriation was properly a concern for a political party and properly a function for the federal government. In his first annual message, he referred to this class of liberated Negroes and proposed that Congress consider colonizing them at some place or places in a climate congenial to them. If it be said that the only legitimate object of acquiring territory is to furnish homes for white men, this measure affects that object, for the emigration of coloured men leaves additional room for white men remaining or coming here. President Lincoln knew that Southern economy was based on cheap Negro labour, and white men's labour made cheap through competition with Negro labour. He was of Anglo-Saxon descent, born in the South. He knew that the upper-class Southerners, so-called, while boasting of Saxon blood, for the first time in Saxon history, were maintaining an economy under which the poor of the race were compelled to compete against the lowly and helpless Negro in order to get food for their children. Again, in his second annual message, he refers to the competition of the races. Reduce the supply of black labour by colonising the black labour out of the country, and by precisely so much you increase the demand for and the wages of white labour. The question of what classes of Negroes would be entitled to government assistance in the President's scheme of colonisation is easily settled. His plans included all classes. There were three classes: free Negroes, slaves held by loyal citizens, and slaves held by persons in arms against the general government. July 12, 1862, the President assembled members of Congress from the border states and told them he favoured compensated emancipation and colonisation. August 14th, he assembled free Negroes in the White House, urged colonisation upon them, and asked for volunteers. September 22nd, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which would effect slaves held by citizens in arms against the Union, and more than half of that document, prior to announcing freedom for the slaves, is given to the question of Negro colonization. The boldness of Abraham Lincoln's spirit and the comprehensiveness of his plans would justify our statement above that he is the greatest of the colonizationists. A distinguished British Jew, Lord Melchett, considered the application of the selective age principle to the colonization of Polish Jews to relieve the race pressure in that country. Discussing the effect of transferring vigorous youths, he said, "Careful statistical inquiry shows that the effect on the future numerical strength of a given population, if all persons of the age group are removed annually, is very striking. The effect of such a transference would be to nearly halve the original population in 20 years, and in about 40 years to reduce it to about 14% of its former size." President Lincoln knew that a race could be transferred by removing only a portion of its numbers. And so did Thomas Jefferson, for the latter proposed that the selective age group be composed of males of the age of 21 and females of the age of 18. The effect of this method would be that the increase of the race would tend to be in its new home and its decrease be in its old home. The tragic death of President Lincoln gave opportunity for men of lesser mould to suppress the Negro repatriation movement in the North, just as the slave power in the South had brought to naught the initial repatriation movement which had been set in motion by the most eminent statesmen that the South had produced. There is ample evidence that these little men in both North and South were actuated by prospects of personal gain, and that their unwillingness to give the Negro a nation of his own was not unrelated to their plan to retain the Negro here and use him for their own peculiar advantage. The conferring of citizenship upon the Negro, however, did not suppress the Negro's desire for independent nationality. As a citizen, the Negro clamour for separate nationality continues, and its expression exceeds that of the free Negro in the days of slavery. When the Venerable Turner wrote the letter quoted above, there was in Jamaica, the British West Indies, a Negro youth, Marcus Garvey, who was destined to be the greatest advocate of race progress, race integrity, and race nationality that the Negro race has ever produced. With good education, Garvey, in his youth, brooded over the disadvantages suffered by his race in contrast with other races. Highly endowed with qualities which made him the outstanding champion of Negro race advancement, he organized the Universal Negro Improvement Association. An able publicist, he spoke in terms that interpreted the race's innermost desire for economic progress, blood integrity, and race nationality. With the purpose to unify the Negroes of the New World with those of the Old, Garvey's organization became international. It developed into a far-flung empire of sentiment and practical effort. Its membership is said to have reached a total of more than 6 million. The writer of this article has personal knowledge that the organization was widespread, for he has corresponded with members of it in 26 of the states, in Jamaica, Panama, Honduras, Cuba, Haiti, San Domingo, and several other countries, including supporters of the movement in 3 or 4 political divisions of Africa. The Garvey movement succeeded in doing well what other Negro repatriation movements had failed to do. It gained the attention of the American press. There was provision for organized hilarity among the Garvey following when their organization met in convention. The American press deals understandingly and leniently with the American Legions 40 and 8, but the organized buffoonery of the Universal Negro Improvement Association's conventions was played up by the press, almost to the exclusion of the great ideals of the organization. This Negro organization, in a plan to aid Liberia, believed that it had acquired certain rights in that country, and sent out a shipment of goods of the value, it is said, of $50,000, when the Liberian end of the agreement was rescinded. It was about this time that other American citizens were more successful in acquiring holdings in Liberia, but the other Americans, not being of Negro descent, could not become citizens of Liberia nor hold title to its land. This obstacle was overcome by leasing 1 million acres of Liberian land for a period of 99 years. Garvey had said much about the white man seizing Negro Africa and holding its people in subjection. He foresaw the time when Africa would be ruled by the Africans. In opposing the white occupation of Africa, Garvey was not more intemperate than Bishop Turner had been, but Turner's declaration to the effect that the British would be defeated and driven back to the waters of the Thames attracted little attention in Europe. Garvey aroused interest there, for a vast concourse of Negroes in the Old World and the New gave the nod of assent to Garvey's doctrine of Africa for the Africans. Opposed by many Negro leaders who felt that they were being displaced, particularly by the type of leader who favoured amalgamation and not separation as a solution of the race problem, opposed, possibly, also by whites in high places who feared international objection to the doctrine of Africa for the Africans, Garvey nevertheless was secure. His enemies were numerous and some of them powerful, but they could not break his hold on the common people of the Negro race. But Garvey undertook to finance the Black Star Line of steamships, to trade among Negro peoples and assist in carrying emigrants to Africa. He was convicted of having used the mails to sell stock in the Black Star Line, stock deemed by a white judge and jury not to have been of immediate or prospective value. This conviction was before the mighty economic collapse known as the Depression, which began in 1929. Garvey had been considered an impractical dreamer, afflicted with a messianic complex, from whom the stock-purchasing individuals of his race should be protected. Shortly after his conviction, much stock issued by practical men, not afflicted with a messianic complex in any form, was as worthless as the stock of the Black Star Line. President Coolidge commuted Garvey's sentence, but Garvey was an alien and was automatically exiled from the United States. His popularity was not greatly reduced by the prison sentence, for his followers generally were in sympathy with the purpose of the Black Star Line. But his imprisonment deprived him of active leadership. His exile from the United States separated him from the largest group of his followers, and the worldwide depression also served to reduce the organization's great membership. It continues, however, and is rebuilding a large membership. After the exile of Garvey, there arose Negro leaders, several of them, who sought to effect a minor program of Negro repatriation. Their particular interest was directed towards securing and developing small concessions in Liberia, or in effecting small settlements on Liberian land. Garvey had proved to be the greatest of the Negro publicists and the greatest of the Negro organizers. There was now to arise a mighty Negro repatriation movement not dependent upon press publicity. Garvey aided the cause of Negro repatriation, but his organization also carried other concepts of racial uplift. The new movement is confined to a single ideal: to return people of African descent to their motherland, Africa. It was this new movement, a peace movement, which prepared the giant Negro memorial to President Roosevelt, as given above. The leading personage in securing this great petition to the president was a woman, Mrs. M.M.L. Gordon, the president of the peace movement, an indomitable spirit, making hundreds of speeches, carrying on extensive correspondence, rallying those whose hope was weak, and instilling a rugged enthusiasm for the cause of Negro repatriation. The memorial is wholly the work of Negroes. In its implications, it would affect the future of the white race and the black, as no other measure brought forward since the days of Abraham Lincoln could affect them. In the scant space given in the press to the Negro memorial, there was a tendency to treat it lightly. Paul Cuff relied upon his personal resources to begin the repatriation movement. Marcus Garvey sought to have Negroes by their own ships. Cuff's purpose was understood and supported by eminent white people. Garvey begged for white understanding and support, but it was not accorded him. Bishop Turner frankly recognised that any effective programme of racial repatriation was beyond the power of the American Negro, and he held that the movement should have biracial support, for both races would profit by it. The president of the peace movement, her capable advisers, and the signers of the mighty memorial asked for white support on the assumption that the movement would benefit the condition of the whites, particularly white labourers. Lincoln and Clay often used a similar approach, an economic one, but the signers of the memorial showed as well a spiritual longing to live among a people of their own kind. American Negroes are divided on the question of repatriation as a solution of the race problem. This we know, for some of the Negroes openly advocate amalgamation of the races. The failure of the repatriationists to gain the support of the whites is held by the amalgamationists to be an evidence that their own preferred solution is to win public approval, and that in no distant future the two races will merge into a mulatto type. With Garvey and Gordon dead, the amalgamationists feel secure, but not quite secure, for a recent memorial to Congress by a great state asking that body to assist Negroes who desire to settle in Liberia encouraged the repatriationists, and at the same time created misgiving and uncertainty in the hitherto confident ranks of the amalgamationists. There are not many white people who know of this division in the Negro race, for it seems to be generally assumed by the whites that all Negroes would welcome the chance to lose their race identity by mixing with the whites. What type of Negro, then, are the repatriationists who propose to maintain the Negro type under conditions which would ensure race integrity? Racially, those who propose to maintain their racial type and achieve conditions to ensure this purpose would be the biological element upon which the race would have to depend. Racially, this element would be the elite of the race, while racially those with adverse proposal would be racial refuse, however valuable their qualities, as individuals. The fact that Negro leaders, the eminent ones, named in this article, and a host of others less known to fame, have always obtained an immediate following when advocating Negro nationality, is evidence that the Negro has pride in his race, and a practical desire for it to stand alone and strive as other races. But it is evidence ignored by many white people who glibly state that the Negro has neither desire for race integrity nor ambition to achieve race nationality. It is evident that the Reconstruction Amendments to the Federal Constitution did not operate to deaden the Negro desire for race nationality. In addition to the Negro nationalists who have kept their ideals since these amendments, there also have been capable white individuals who advocated Negro nationalism. President Grant, United States Senators Ingalls of Kansas, Morgan of Alabama, Tillman of South Carolina, Varda Damman of Mississippi, and Garraway of Arkansas. Governors Jelks of Alabama and Broward of Florida are on record as favouring racial separation. The Negro nationalists were profoundly grateful for the Virginia Memorial to Congress on their behalf, but there is, I believe, equal if not better evidence of potential white support for their cause in a measure brought forward in Mississippi in 1928. It was passed by a great majority in the Senate, reported favourably by the House Committee on Federal Relations, but lost in the last days of the session. In Virginia, Negroes appeared before committees and sympathetic white citizens gave them their support. In Mississippi, no Negroes had requested aid. The measure originated within the Senate, and it is a majestic one, showing a lofty sense of responsibility of the white race to provide for and to give full aid to Negroes who desire a national home. Be it resolved, by the Senate of the State of Mississippi, the House of Representatives concurring therein, that we do hereby most solemnly memorialize the Congress of the United States of America to request the President to acquire by treaty, negotiations or otherwise from our late war allies sufficient territory on the continent of Africa to make a suitable, proper, and final home for the American Negro, where, under the tutelage of the American government, he can develop for himself a great republic, to become in time a free and sovereign state, and take its place at the council boards of the nations of the world, and to use such part of our allied war debt as may be necessary in acquiring such territorial concession, to the end that our country may become one in blood as in spirit, and that the dream of our forefathers may be realized in the final colonization of the American Negro on his native soil, and that the spirit of race consciousness now so manifest in the American Negro may be given an opportunity for development under the most advantageous circumstances. Abraham Lincoln, in his great understanding and foresight, had not only been deeply concerned about the repatriation of the millions of slaves in the South, but was also particularly disturbed about the black troops to be discharged from the Union Army. He felt that this situation would aggravate the wounds of the war and would jeopardize the development of a friendly feeling between the two sections. This is most clearly evidenced by a conversation that Lincoln had with Benjamin F. Butler in early April of 1865. Butler narrates in his autobiography what the president said on this occasion. "But what shall we do with the Negroes after they are free? I can hardly believe that the South and the North can live in peace unless we can get rid of the Negroes. Certainly they cannot if we don't get rid of the Negroes whom we have armed and disciplined and who have fought with us, to the amount, I believe, of some 150,000 men. I believe that it would be better to export them all to some fertile country with a good climate, which they could have to themselves. You have a staunch friend of the race from the time you first advised me to enlist them at New Orleans. You have had a good deal of experience in moving bodies of men by water. Your movement up the James was a magnificent one. Now we shall have use for our very large navy. What, then, are our difficulties in sending all the blacks away? If these black soldiers of ours go back to the South, I'm afraid that they will be but little better off with their masters than they were before, and yet they will be free men. I fear a race war, and it will be at least a guerrilla war, because we have taught these men how to fight. All the arms of the South are now in the hands of their troops, and when we capture them, we, of course, will take their arms. There are plenty of men in the North who will furnish the Negroes with arms if there is any oppression of them by their late masters. I wish you would carefully examine the question, and give me your views upon it, and go into the figures, as you did before in some degree, so as to show whether the Negroes can be exported. I wish also you would give me any views that you have as to how to deal with the Negro troops after the war." The significance of this conversation between President Lincoln and General Butler is that it clearly establishes Lincoln had not changed his views on the subject of Negro colonization towards the end of his life. Indeed, it shows he held these convictions to the very end, as his death occurred no more than a week or 10 days later, on April 15th, 1865. Thus, we find some of the last words Lincoln uttered were on the need to colonize the Negro, and it is not strange that this was so, for these thoughts expressed the very core and foundation of his Negro policy. With him gone, the nation lost one of its greatest opportunities to eliminate the Negro problem from the United States of America for all time. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion narrations in the future.